This is Audible.
Audible Frontiers presents Night of the Hunter, written by R.A. Salvatore, narrated by Victor Bavine. Prologue. So much blood. Everywhere, blood. It followed Doomwheel wherever she traveled. She saw it on her silvery skin. Skin that spoke of her mixed elf and drow heritage. It followed her in her dreams, each night, every night. She saw it on the footprints she left in the snow. She saw it on her keen-edged sword. Yes, on the sword most of all. It was always there, reflected in the red edge of the sentient weapon, Cassidea. A thousand times had she stabbed that blade through her brother's heart. His screams echoed between the beats of her every waking thought and filled her dreams, sweet music to the sensibilities of Cassidea. Her brother Tyr Flynn had tried to stab her with that very sword, with her sword, as she slept one day, but she had been quicker. She had been better. She had been more worthy. She felt the blade entering his chest, easily shearing through skin and muscle and bone, reaching for his heart so that the delicious blood might flow freely. She could never wash that blood from her hands. But at that time, in the thralls of the weapon, with the warm words of her father whispering into her ear, she didn't want to wash the blood from her hands. Perhaps Tyr Flynn's dying screams were music, after all. Two, the drow's fingers indicated, and the motion continued in the intricate silent hand language of the cunning race. Moving stealthily. To Sabarak Zor-Lauren, noble wizard of Menzo Berenzon's third house, carefully considered his next move. He wasn't comfortable out here, so far from both Menzo Berenzon and Q'Zor Lauren, the new drow city his family was creating in the mines of the ancient dwarven homeland of Gontalgrim. He was fairly sure that he knew why Matron Xerath had sent him, particularly him, on this distant reconnoiter. Xerath wanted to keep him far from Ravel, her son, who was a bitter rival of Tesabarak. And a bitter rival who had surely gained the upper hand, Tesabarak had to admit. With his successful infiltration of the ancient dwarven homeland, Ravel had become the shining fairy fire to accent the glory of House Zor-Lauren. And he had done so in the company of a Baenri, no less, and with the blessing of that powerful clan. The city of Q'Zor-Lauren was well on its way to becoming reality. And Ravel had played the paramount role in that development. The wizard's fingers moved quickly, speaking to the point, demanding more information from the scouts. He sent them forth and headed back the other way, where his cousin Berilip, Ravel's older sister, waited. He spotted her among the entourage, still in a small natural chamber off to the side of the underground river that had been guiding them thus far. Berilip Zor-Lauren was rarely hard to find, after all. Brash and loud, she kept the inferior commoner males far away, with only her two young female attendants allowed to even address her. Tesabarak moved across the small room and waved those attendants away.
"You have found them?"
Tesabarak nodded.
"Two, at least, moving along the lower tunnels."
"Orcs?"
The maid shrugged.
"We do not know yet. Stealthier than orcs, it would seem. Clever goblins, perhaps."
"I can smell the orc stench all about us," Berilip said with obvious disgust.
Tesabarak again could only shrug. They had come here, to these tunnels underneath the northern reaches of the Silver Marches, with full expectation that they would encounter many orcs. After all, up above them was the land of King Obuld, the kingdom of many arrows.
"I view your smirk as an invitation to play," Berilip warned, her hand moving near to the hilt of her snake-headed whip.
"My apologies, priestess.
de Saperac said, and he bowed deferentially. This one did so love to put that whip to its painful work on the flesh of drow males. I was merely wondering if a goblin tribe taken as prisoners would suffice upon our return to Cusor Lauren.
You still believe that we were sent out here to secure slaves?
Partly, the wizard answered honestly.
I know of other reasons why I might be moved aside for the present. I am not certain, however, why you would be so removed in this time of great upheaval and glory for the house.
Because Matron Xerith determined it, the priestess answered through tight lips. De Saberach bowed again, confirming that such an answer was, of course, all that he needed or deserved. She closely guarded her thoughts, as was often her way, and De Saberach could only accept it for what it was. He and Berylip had spoken many times of the purpose of their mission, in conversations where Berylip had been far more open and even critical of Matron Xerith. But such was the nature of Berylip Zor-Lauren that she could simply, stubbornly, pretend that those previous discussions had never taken place.
It was not only Matron Xerith who determined our course and the composition of our troop, he boldly remarked.
You do not know this.
I have known Archmage Grump Beanry for 2 centuries. His hand is in this.
Berylip's face grew very tight, and she muttered,
Beanry's hand is in everything.
A clear reference to Tiago Beanry, the first house's official escort to Ravel's mission that had conquered Gauntlegrim. Berylip had made no secret to De Saperac of her distaste for the brash young noble warrior in the early days of their journey east. Berylip's scorn for Tiago came as no surprise to De Saperac. He knew Tiago fairly well, and the young warrior's propensity to forego the station afforded mere males and to throw the weight of House Beanry behind his imperial attitude was well documented among the lesser houses in Menzo Berenzon. Besides, rumors whispered that Tiago would soon wed Sarabel Zor-Lauren, Berylip's younger, and by all accounts and all measures, inferior sister, having chosen her above Berylip. No doubt, De Saberac realized, Berylip thought much the same of Sarabel as she did of Ravel.
What business would the Archmage have with us out here?
Berylip asked, despite her smug superiority.
He would bid Matron Xerith to send a high priestess and a master of sorcerer off on an errand to collect simple slaves?
There is more, De Saberac said with confidence. He reminded her of a previous conversation by continuing.
The Spider Queen is pleased with our journey, so you have assured me.
He held his breath as he finished, expecting Berylip to lash out at him, but was pleasantly surprised when she simply nodded and said,
Something larger is afoot. We will know when Matron Xerith determines that we should know.
Or when Archmage Grumph determines it, De Saberac dared to say. And Berylip's eyes flashed with anger. He was quite relieved then, at that very moment, when his scouts returned, rushing into the side chamber.
Not goblins, one reported, clearly excited.
Drow,
said the other.
Drow?
Berylip asked. She and De Saberac exchanged looks. There were no drow cities out here that either knew of.
Perhaps we will soon find our answers.
De Saberac's fingers silently flashed to his cousin, the mage taking care to keep the signal out of sight of the scouts and others in the room. The 2 lithe figures sat on a ledge, halfway up an underground cliff face. Water poured from the tunnel opening above them, diving down to an underground lake below. Despite the narrow and seemingly precarious perch in the meager light of a few scattered lichens, neither shifted around nor clenched uncomfortably.
Why must we ascend this cliff?
Asked the woman, Doomwheel, the younger of the elves. She hauled up the rope from below. She had to speak loudly to be heard over the sound of the falling, splashing water. which made the other, older figure, her father, wish that he had properly instructed her in the ways of Drow sign language.
I thought our plan was to descend through the Underdark,
Doomwheel added sarcastically. The darker-skinned Drow at her side took a bite of an Underdark mushroom, then looked at it distastefully.
This is the path I took when I left my home, he answered.
The young elf woman, half drow, half moon elf, leaned out a bit from the ledge and twirled the grapnel end of the rope, preparing to throw. She stopped mid-swing and stared at her companion incredulously.
That was 100 years ago, she reminded. How can you remember the path you took?
He tossed the rest of the mushroom from the ledge, gingerly stood one leg showing garish wounds, and wiped his hands on his breeches.
I always knew I would return someday. The woman spun the rope once more and let fly, the grapnel disappearing into the black hole of the tunnel entrance above. So I never let myself forget the way, he said as she tested the grip of the grapnel. Although the waterfall wasn't here last time.
Well, that's promising,
she quipped and began to climb. Her father watched her with pride. He noted the sword she carried sheathed on her hip, his sword, Kazidea, the cutter, a sentient and powerful blade known for driving its weaker wielders into savage madness. His daughter was gaining control of the bloodthirsty weapon. No small feat, he knew from painful personal experience. She wasn't halfway up to the tunnel when he jumped onto the fine, strong elven cord, his sinewy arms propelling him upward, quickly behind her. He had nearly made the ledge as she rolled herself over it, turning to offer him a hand, which he took and scrambled over. She said something to him, but he didn't hear her. Not then. Not when he was looking at a line of approaching enemies, arms extended, hand crossbows leveled his way. Standing in the mouth of a tunnel opposite the waterfall, the same course his prey had taken, Tesabarak Zorlaren watched the pair ascend the cliff face from across the underground lake. He had found them quite easily, and with his considerable magical abilities had trailed them closely, and indeed, with a wide smile, though it could not be viewed since he was under the enchantment of invisibility, for he was fairly certain that he knew this wayward drow. He wondered what Berylip Zorlaren would do when she discovered this one's identity as a once-favored son of Menzo Baranzon's second house, the greatest rival family of House Zorlaren.
"Tread cautiously, witch,"
he whispered, his words buried beneath the din of the waterfall. He could have used one of his spells to magically send a word of warning to Berylip's ambush group, and indeed he almost began the spell. But he changed his mind and smiled wider, and wider still when he heard the female cry out and saw a flash of lightning just within the tunnel entrance. As a precaution, Tesabarak moved to the base of the cliff, noting two solid anchor points, stalagmites, as he began to cast a spell. Pops and crackles sounded above the rush of water as Doomwheel's lightning sheet intercepted the incoming hand crossbow bolts. Their momentum stolen, they fell harmlessly to the ground. "To my side," she cried to her father, but she needn't have bothered, for the veteran warrior was already moving to that very spot, sliding in beside her up against the tunnel wall. Like her, he clearly had no desire to battle the incoming warriors with his back to a cliff ledge. He drew out his two swords, she her one. She only held one blade, for Kazidhea would not allow a sister weapon, would not share in the glory of the kill. Three drow males swept in before the pair. They kept their backs to the rushing river with practiced coordination, one sliding, one leaping, another running in to defend his comrades, and all three with two swords drawn. The sliding drow popped right to his feet in front of Doomwheel's father, with a double-up cross of his blades, drawing his opponent's swords up high. The leaping, somersaulting drow landed beside him, and before the drow had even touched down, he stabbed one blade out toward Doomwheel and one out at her father. And with the third drow coming in hard at her and demanding a double parry, Doomwheel only barely avoided being stabbed in the face.
Do not kill her, father cried, though whether he was speaking to her or imploring their enemies she could not tell. Nor would she have followed the command in any case, her sword thirsting for blood, demanding blood, any blood. She swept Cassidea across with a powerful backhand, taking her attacker's two swords aside. He rolled his trailing blade as she rolled Cassidea, both stabbing out. Dumwheel couldn't retreat with the wall against her back, but her strike drove her opponent back so that his sword too could not reach her. One against one, and with Cassidea in hand, she was certain she could defeat this formidable warrior. But she wasn't one against one, and neither was her father. The drow centering the trio of enemies worked his blades independently, left and right, stabbing at both between the twirl of counters and parries. No! Cassidea screamed in her thoughts as it sensed her intentions. The demand of the sword carried little weight, though, for Dumwheel's movements were driven by desperate need, not choice. The young half-drow battle mage stabbed straight ahead, swept her blade out to deflect a strike from the centering enemy, then stabbed ahead again, driving her immediate opponent back. She timed his retreat perfectly with the release of magic, a spell that sent him skidding into the river on the slippery stones. He thrashed and cried out, and was caught by the current and washed past his companions and out over the ledge. No, her father cried at her, but for far different reasons than had the sword she held. Cassidea's cry was in denial of her use of magic, she understood, for the sword wanted all the glory and all the blood. Her father, however, apparently still thought that they could find the time to barter and defuse the situation, a notice Dumwheel thought all the more ridiculous because of the mocking response of Cassidea in her mind. Noting that other enemies were near at hand and closing fast, Dumwheel turned fast on the second drow in line, thinking to drive him into the enemy facing her father. But this time he proved the quicker, and as she advanced he leaped back and leaped high, one hand going to a brooch on his cloak tie, his house insignia. The magic of that jewelry brought forth a spell of levitation, and the drow floated out across the underground river. Dumwheel thought to pursue, but Cassidea drove her forward instead, sensing the vulnerability of the third in line, who was already entangled with her father. That enemy turned to meet her rush and managed to partially deflect her leading strike. Partially. But the devilish Cassidea got through and so easily pierced his fine drow chainmail and so beautifully slid into his skin. A look of delicious horror on his face, the drow threw himself backward and flew from the ledge into the open air of the vast chamber beyond. Dumwheel turned with her father, side by side once more and facing into the tunnel, where four drow warriors, including the one who had levitated away across the river, stood in a line, lifting hand crossbows once more. "And now we die," her father said with resignation. "Enough!" came a loud cry, volume clearly magically enhanced from behind the enemy line. It was a call that would surely carry the weight of command among any raised in Menzo Baranzon, for it had sounded in a female voice. The drow line parted, and between the warriors passed a female, dressed in fine black robes, adorned with spider-shaped charms and elaborate designs. Even Dumwheel, who had no experience with drow culture other than the teachings of her father, could not miss the significance. This was a priestess of the goddess Lolth, and one of great power. For she held the terrible weapon of her high station, a snake-headed whip, four living serpents weaving eagerly in the air at her side, ready to strike at her command. "Who are you, and why are you here?" Dumwheel asked in the language of the drow, which her father had taught her.
"Ah, yes, introductions," her father said. "I would have offered them earlier, but your warriors were too busy trying to kill me."
The snakes of the female's whip hissed, reflecting her ire.
"You dare speak to a high priestess with such insolence?"
Dumwheel was surprised to see her father fall back a step, clearly intimidated. He had underestimated her rank, and did not seem overly confident now that it had been revealed.
"Forgive me," he said with a graceful bow. "I am
Tosin Armgo, of House Barrison del Armgo,"
Dumwheel finished for him.
"And I am Dumwheel Armgo of the same house."
She stepped forward,
Cassiodeia at the ready, its red edge shining angrily, hungrily.
"You will escort us to Menzo Berenzon," she ordered, "where we will rejoin our house."
She couldn't tell if the stately priestess opposing her was impressed or amused.
"Children of Barris and Dalarmgo, Menzo Berenzon does not rule here," she said evenly.
She was amused, Doomwheel realized, and that did not bode well.
"The city of Cusor Lauren, though, will greet you," the priestess said.
And Tosin sighed, and Doomwheel thought it and hoped it to be an expression of great relief.
"Cusor Lauren?" he asked. "Housor Lauren has built a city?"
He half turned to Doomwheel and whispered, "My little doe, our new life may yet prove more interesting than I had planned."
"Yes, Housor Lauren," the priestess responded. "Once the third house of Menzo Berenzon, now greater, greater than the second house, it would seem."
The way she had spoken seemed to take the hope from her father's face, Doomwheel noted.
"Tosin Armgo,"
came a male voice from behind, and Doomwheel and Tosin turned in unison to see a drow floating in the air just beyond the ledge. Doomwheel moved as if to lash out with magic, but her father grabbed her arm and held her still. When she looked at him, she understood that he thought them clearly overmatched.
"To Sabarak?" he asked.
The floating mage laughed and bowed, which seemed almost comical while hanging in midair.
"A friend?"
Doomwheel whispered hopefully.
"Drow don't have friends," Tosin whispered back.
"Indeed,"
the Sabarak Zorlaren agreed.
"And yet, I have done you a great service, and likely saved you from summary execution."
He pointed down below him, and Doomwheel and Tosin dared to inch closer and glance down over the ledge to see the two drow warriors they had driven over caught helplessly, but safely, in a magical web strung near the bottom of the watery cavern.
"My cousin, the eldest daughter of Matron Xerith, has only recently been granted, by the will of the goddess, a fourth snake for her implement of Lolth's mercy, and is eager to put the serpent to use, I would expect. Berylip is not known to show mercy on those who kill Zorlarens."
"Perhaps, then, she should not send Zorlarens to attack the children of House Barris and Dalarmgo,"
Doomwheel imperiously replied. Tosin gasped and moved to stop her, and indeed she did bite off the end of that retort. But only because four living snakes, the heads of Berylip's mighty whip, bit her in the back for her impudence. Cassiodeia screamed at her to retaliate, but the poison and the agony denied that, driving Doomwheel to her knees. And so her lesson had begun. Part 1. Together in Darkness. Do people really change? I thought about this question so many times over the last decades, and how poignant it seemed to me when I happened once more upon Artemis and Treri, shockingly alive given the passage of a century. I came to travel with him, to trust him even. Does that mean that I came to believe that he had changed? Not really. And now that we have once more parted ways, I don't believe there to be a fundamental difference in the man, compared to the Entreri I fought beside in the Undercity of Mithril Hall when it was still in the hands of the Duergar, or the Entreri I pursued to Kalimport when he abducted Regis. Fundamentally, he is the same man. As fundamentally, I am the same drow. A person may learn and grow, and thus react differently to a recurring situation. That is the hope I hold for all people, for myself, for societies even. Is that not the whole point of gaining experience? To use it to make wiser choices, to temper destructive instincts, to find better resolutions? In that regard, I do believe Artemis Entreri to be a changed man, slower in turning to the dagger for resolution, though no less deadly when he needs it.
but fundamentally, regarding what lies in the man's heart, he is the same. I know that to be true of myself, although in retrospect, I walked a very different path over the last few years than that I purposefully strode for the majority of my life. Darkness found my heart, I admit. With the loss of so many dear friends came the loss of hope itself, and so I gave in to the easier path, although I had vowed almost every day that such a cynical journey would not be the road of Drisdo Erden. Fundamentally, though, I did not change. And so when faced with the reality of the darkened road, when it came time for me to admit the path to myself, I could not go on. I cannot say that I miss Dahlia and Treri and the others. My heart does not call out for me to go and find them, surely. But I am not so certain that I could confidently claim such a casual attitude about my decision to part ways, had it not been for the return of those friends I hold most dear. How can I regret parting with Dahlia when the fork in our road led me directly back into the arms of Catti Bree? And thus, here I stand, together once more beside the companions of the hall, rejoined with the truest and dearest friends I have ever known and could ever hope to know. Have they changed? Have their respective journeys through the realm of death itself brought to these four friends a new and guiding set of principles that will leave me sorely disappointed as I come to know them once more? That is a fear I hold, but hold afar. For people do not fundamentally change, so I believe. The warmth of Catti Bree's embrace is one inspiring confidence that I am right. The mischievous grin of Regis, even with the mustache and goatee, is one I have seen before. And Brunner's call that night under the stars atop Kelvin's cairn, and his reaction to Wolfgar, aye, that was Brunner, true to the thick bone and thick head. All that said, in these first days together, I have noted a change in Wolfgar's step, I admit. There is a lightness there I have not seen before, and curiously, I say, given the description I have been told of his reluctance to leave Eruladun for the mortal world once more, a smile that never seems to leave his face. But he is Wolfgar, surely, the proud son of Beornagar. He has found some enlightenment, though in what way I cannot say. Enlightened and lightened. I see no burden there. I see amusement and joy, as if he views this all as a grand adventure on borrowed time, and I cannot deny the health of that perspective. They are back. We are back, the companions of the hall. We are not as we once were, but our hearts remain true, our purpose joined, and our trust for each other undiminished and thus unbridled. I am very glad of that. And in a curious way, and a surprising way to me, I hold no regrets for the last few years of my journey through a life confusing, frightening, and grand all at once. My time with Dahlia, and particularly with Entreri, was one of learning, I must believe. To see the world through a cynical perspective did not hurl me back to the days of my youth in Menzo Baranzon, and thus encapsulate me in darkness, but rather has offered to me a more complete understanding of the consequence of choice. For I broke free of the cynicism before knowing what fate awaited me atop Brunner's climb. I am not so self-centered as to believe that the world around me is created for me. We all play such self-centered games at times, I suppose. But in this case, I will allow myself one moment of self-importance, to accept the reunion of the companions of the hall as a reward to me. Put whatever name you wish upon the gods and goddesses, or the fates, or the coincidences and twists that move the world along its path, it matters not. In this one instance, I choose to believe in a special kind of justice. Indeed, it is a foolish and self-serving claim, I know. but it feels good. Drizzt Do'Urden. Chapter 1. The Seasoned Matron Bayenry. It seemed just another day for Matron Mother Quenthel Bayenry as she went to her evening prayers. Her magnificent black robes, laced like flowing spider webs, swirled around her as she regally moved along the center aisle, passing the inferior priestesses at the many side altars of the Bayenry House Chapel. The slightest breeze could send the spidery ends of that robe drifting upward and outward, blurring the form of the matron mother, giving her the appearance of etherealness and otherworldliness. Quenthel's sole surviving sister, Sosumtu, the first priestess of the house and keeper of the chapel, had preceded her to prayer this evening and now prostrated herself, face down on the stone floor, legs tucked in a tight kneeling position. Quenthel considered that image as she neared, noting that Sosumtu had her forearms and hands flat on the floor above her head, up toward the altar, a position of complete supplication and apology even, and not the typical form for daily prayers by the leading priestesses. A priestess of Sosumtu's station rarely assumed so humble an entreaty. Quenthel walked up close enough to hear her sister's chanted prayer, and indeed, it was an apology, and a desperate one at that. The matron mother listened for a bit longer, hoping to catch some hint of why Sosumtu would be apologizing, but caught nothing specific.
"Dear sister,"
she said when Sosumtu finally broke from her fevered chant. The first priestess raised her hand and turned to glance back.
"Supplicate," Sosumtu whispered urgently. "At once!"
Quenthel's first instinct was to lash out at Sosumtu for her disrespectful tone and for daring to order her to do anything. She even put a hand to her snake-headed whip, where the five writhing, sentient serpents continued their eternal dance. She was surprised as she grasped the weapon, though, for even Kasothra, the most bloodthirsty of the serpents, warned her away from that course, and rare indeed was it for Kasothra to ever counsel anything but the lash.
"Hear her,"
purred Shiv, the advisor serpent.
"Sosumtu is devout,"
Ingoth agreed. With the counsel of the serpents, the matron mother realized that only a matter of great importance would ever coax such irreverence from her sister. After all, Sosumtu was much like Triel, their deceased older sister, reserved and quietly calculated. The matron mother straightened her robes out behind her and fell to her knees beside the first priestess, face down, arms extended in full surrender. She heard the screaming, shrieking actually, immediately, the discordant cacophony of demons and of Lady Loth herself, full of outrage and venom. Something was very much amiss, clearly. Quenthel tried to sort through the possibilities. Menzo Baranzon remained on edge, as did most of Toril, as the world continued its realignment after the end of the spell plague some 5 years previous. But the Drow city had fared well in that time, Quenthel believed. House Sorlaren, third house of Menzo Baranzon, in league with House Bayenry, had established a strong foothold in the dwarven complex formerly known as Gontalgrim and soon to be known as Cusor Laren. The great and ancient forge, powered by nothing less than a primordial of fire, had blazed to life, and weapons of fine edge and mighty enchantment had begun to flow back to Menzo Baranzon. So secure did the new sister city seem that Matron Zira Zorlaren herself had begun to make preparations for her departure, and had requested of Menzo Baranzon's ruling council that it approve the name of Cusor Laren for the new settlement, and as the permanent abode for her powerful house. Replacing that house on the Council of Eight could prove messy, of course, as was always the case when those houses immediately below the top eight ranks saw a chance at ascendance. But Quenthel remained confident that she had those issues under control. Bregendierth, too, was thriving, with the resulting trade flowing in and out of Menzo Baranzon, under the leadership of Kimuriel and Jarlaxle. The mercenaries had come to dominate the surface city of Luskin, and quietly, so as not to provoke the curiosity or ire of the lords of the surrounding kingdoms, particularly the powerful city of Waterdeep. The matron mother subtly shook her head. Menzo Berenzon was operating quite smoothly under her leadership. Perhaps these screams were prompted by something else. She tried to widen her focus beyond the reach of Menzo Berenzon's tentacles. But the sudden shriek in her head left no doubt that Lolth's anger this night was focused, and focused squarely on House Bayenry, or at least on Menzo Berenzon. After a long while of accepting the telepathic berating, Quentha lifted herself up to a kneeling position and motioned for Sosumtu to do likewise. Her sister came up shaking her head, her expression as full of confusion as Quenthel's own.
"The source of Queen Lolth's ire?"
Quenthel's fingers asked in the intricate drow sign language. Sosumtu shook her head helplessly. Matron Mother Quentha looked at the grand altar, its standing backdrop a gigantic, drider-like figure. Its eight spider legs were tucked in a squat, and it bore the head and torso of a female drow, the beautiful figure of Lady Lolth herself. Quentha closed her eyes and listened once more, then fell to the floor in supplication yet again. But the shrieks would not provide focus. Quenthel gradually came back to a kneeling position, no less confused or concerned. She crossed her arms over her chest and rocked slowly, seeking guidance. She put her hand on her sentient weapon, but the serpents remained silent, uncharacteristically so. At length, she lifted her hands and signed to her sister.
"Get you to Erech Tynaleth, and retrieve Mirrineal." "Sister?"
Sosumtu dared to openly question. Erech Tynaleth, the training academy for drow priestesses, served as the greatest of the drow academies, elevated on Tir Bresh above the school of warriors, Mele Magvir, and Sorcerer, the school for promising young wizards. Quenthel shot Sosumtu a threatening glare.
"I should retire to the fane of Corval Shares."
Sosumtu's fingers flashed, referring to the great public cathedral of Menzo Berenzon, one Sosumtu had been instrumental in creating, and in which she served as high priestess.
"I only visited Chapel Bayenry so that I would not be tardy for evening prayers."
Her argument revealed to the matron mother that Sosumtu thought the issue bigger than House Bayenry, encompassing all of Menzo Berenzon, and perhaps that was true. But Quenthel was not about to take the chance of allowing her house to become vulnerable in any way.
"No!"
Quenthel's fingers flashed simply. She saw the disappointment on Sosumtu's face, and knew it was more a matter of the reason for the ordered diversion to Erech Tynaleth than the delay in her return to her precious fane of Corval Shares. Sosumtu was no friend to Mirrineal, Quenthel's eldest daughter, after all. Soon to graduate from Erech Tynaleth, the whispers had already started concerning the expected struggle between Mirrineal and Sosumtu over the title of First Priestess of House Bayenry, which was among the most coveted positions in the Drow City.
"You will work with Mirrineal,"
Quenthel's hand signs explained, and aloud she added,
"Summon a Yawklal in this temple. We will hear the call of Lady Lolth and will answer to her needs."
Up and down the chapel, the matron mother's words were met by rising eyes, even rising priestesses at the proclamation. Summoning a Yawklal was no minor thing after all, and most in attendance had never seen one of Lolth's handmaidens. The matron mother watched the expressions being exchanged among the lessers, wide-eyed, full of apprehension, full of excitement.
"Select half the priestesses of House Bayenry to witness the summoning,"
the matron mother instructed as she rose.
"Make them earn their place of witness."
She threw the train of her spidery gown out behind her and imperiously strode away, appearing the rock of confidence and strength. Inside, though, the matron mother's thoughts roiled, the shrieks of Lolth echoing in her mind. Somehow, someone had erred, and greatly so, and punishment from Lolth was never an easy sentence. Perhaps she should take part in the summoning, she thought, before quickly dismissing the idea. She was the matron mother of House Baenri, after all, the unquestioned ruler of Loth's city of Menzo Berenzon. She would not request the audience of a Yoklo, and would only accept the invitation of one, should it come to that. Besides, high priestesses were only supposed to call upon one of Loth's handmaidens in a dire emergency, and Quenthel wasn't completely sure that's what this was. If not, and the summoning invoked the further displeasure of Loth, better that she was not among those calling. For now, she decided, she should visit with the one she believed to be her only surviving sibling, the Archmage of Menzo Berenzon, her brother Gromph, to learn what he might know. The elder boy of House Baenri, the first child of the great Ivanel, Gromph Baenri, now stood as the oldest living drow in Menzo Berenzon, and had long before earned the distinction as the longest-serving archmage of the city. His tenure predated not only the spell plague, but the time of troubles, and by centuries. It was said that he got along by getting along, and by knowing his place, for though his station afforded him great latitude within Menzo Berenzon, inarguably as the most powerful male drow in the city, he remained, after all, merely a male drow. In theory, therefore, every matron mother and every high priestess outranked him. They were closer to Loth, and the Spider Queen ruled all. Many lesser priestesses had tested that theory against Gromph over the centuries. They were all dead. Even Quenthel. Matron Mother Quenthel herself knocked lightly and politely on the door of the Archmage's private chamber in House Baenri. She might have been more showy and forceful had Gromph been in his residence in the Academy of Sorcerer, but here in House Baenri, the pretense couldn't stand. Quenthel and Gromph, siblings, understood each other, didn't much like each other, but surely needed each other. The old wizard stood up quickly and offered a respectful bow when Quenthel pressed into the room.
"Unexpected," he said.
For indeed, these two spent little time in each other's company, and usually only when Quenthel had summoned Gromph to her formal chair of station. Quenthel closed the door and motioned for her brother to be seated. He noted her nervous movements and looked at her slyly.
"There is news?"
Quenthel took the seat opposite the Archmage, across the great desk, which was covered in parchment, both rolled and spread, with 100 bottles of various inks set about them.
"Tell me of the spell plague," Quenthel bade him.
"It is ended, mercifully," he replied with a shrug. "Magic is as magic was, the weave reborn, and gloriously so."
Quenthel stared at him curiously.
"Gloriously?"
she asked, considering his strange choice of words, and one that surely seemed stranger still, given the typical demeanor of Gromph. Gromph shrugged as if it did not matter to deflect his nosy sister. For once, regarding the movements of Lady Loth, this situation did not yet concern her. For once, the male wizards of Menzo Berenzon had been entreated by the Spider Queen before and above the domineering disciples of Eric Tynalith. Gromph knew that his time standing above Quenthel in Loth's eyes would be brief, but he intended to hold fast to it for as long as possible. Quenthel narrowed her eyes, and Gromph suppressed his smile, knowing that his apparent indifference to such godly games surely irked her.
"The Spider Queen is angry," Quenthel said.
"She is always angry," Gromph replied. "Else she could hardly be considered a demon queen."
"Your jests are noted and will be relayed," Quenthel warned.
Gromph shrugged. He could hardly suppress his laughter. One of them would soon be exposing quite a bit of truth regarding the Spider Queen, he knew, but to Quenthel's surprise, it wouldn't be her.
"You think her current anger is regarding the weave? The end of the spell plague?"
he asked, because he could not resist. He pictured the expression Quenthel would wear when the truth was revealed to her, and it took all that he could muster to not break out in open, mocking laughter.
"5 years it has been. Not so long a time in the eyes of a goddess, true, but still.
Do not mock her,
Quenthal warned.
Of course not. I merely seek to discern.
She is angry,
Quenthal interrupted.
It seemed unfocused, a discordant shriek, a scream of frustration.
She lost,
Grump said matter-of-factly, and he laughed at Quenthal's threatening glare.
It's not about that, the matron mother said with confidence.
Dear sister.
Matron mother,
Quenthal sharply corrected.
Do you fear that the Spider Queen is angry with you?
Grump went on. Quenthal rested back in her chair and stared off into nothingness, contemplating the question far longer than Grump had anticipated. So long, in fact, that the Archmage went back to his work, penning a new scroll.
At us,
Quenthal decided some time later, and Grump looked up at her curiously.
Us? House Bayenry?
Menzo Baronzon, perhaps.
Quenthal waved her hand dismissively, obviously flustered.
I have set So Sumptu and my daughter to the task of summoning a handmaiden, that we might get more definitive answers.
Then pray tell me, dear sister.
Grump folded his hands on the desk before him, staring hard at Quenthal, pointedly referring to her in that less than formal manner.
Why did you decide to disturb my work?
The spell plague, the weave,
the matron mother flailed, again waving her hand.
Nay, that is not the reason, said the old archmage. Why, Quenthal, I believe that you are afraid.
You dare to speak to me in that manner?
Why would I not, dear sister?
Quenthal leaped from her chair, sending it skidding out behind her. Her eyes flashed with outrage as she corrected him once more, spitting every syllable.
Matron mother!
Yes, said Grump. Matron mother of Menzo Baronzon.
He rose to face her directly and matched her unblinking stare with his own.
Never forget that.
You seem to be the one,
Grump rolled right over the thought.
And act the part of it, he said evenly.
Quenthal's eyes flashed again. Her hands clenched and opened as if readying for a spell, but she quickly composed herself. Grump nodded and gave a little laugh.
If the Spider Queen is angry with you when you show any weakness, your doom will fall, he warned. The world above and below is in flux. Lady Lolf's own designs have only begun to spin, and she will brook no weakness now.
Menzo Baronzon thrives under my leadership.
Does it?
House Sorlauren has settled Gontalgrim. The ancient forge is fired anew, and to the benefit of Menzo Baronzon.
And House Barazin Delarmgo?
Grump asked slyly.
Do they view the move of Sorlauren as one that strengthens the hand of Matron Mother Quenthal, or as one that opens an opportunity for them here in the City of Spiders? You have removed a threat to them, have you not?
Their enemies, the Sorlaurens, are not far. Matron Xerath is still within the city,
Quenthal protested.
But when she goes, and the compound here is abandoned, as is soon to occur.
They will not be far.
And if Matron Mez Barisarm go, offer Xerath a better deal than you have offered.
Quenthal slid back into her chair, mulling over that dangerous notion. A long while passed before she looked up across the desk at Grump, who stood towering above her now.
Take heart, dear sister, Grump said lightly. We do not even know the source of Lady Lolf's shriek. Perhaps it is not but a residual scream of frustration over some event in the realm of the gods that has no bearing upon us whatsoever. Perhaps it was not, is not directed at you, or at House Bayenri, or at Menzo Berenzon at all. Who can tell with these gods?
Gwenthel nodded hopefully at that.
They will likely have engaged the Yawklal by now,
she explained, rising once more and turning for the door.
Let us go and get our answers.
You go,
Gromph bade her. He already had his answers, after all.
I have my work here. I will remain in House Bayenri this day and throughout tomorrow in case I am needed.
That seemed to satisfy the matron mother, and she took her leave, and Gromph remained standing until she had closed the door behind her. Then he sat, with a profound sigh. He did not need a handmaiden to enlighten him. Another source, more ancient than he, had already told him of the stirrings of the Spider Queen and Loth's mounting frustration with Menzo Berenzon. Gwenthel would return to him shortly, he knew, and she would not much enjoy the journey he had planned for her. The handmaiden's muddy voice, bubbly and scratchy all at once, fit its physical appearance, that of a half-melted blob of dirty wax, and with several tentacles waving around just to complete the nightmare.
You extend, but you are not strong,
the Yawklal said, clearly irritated.
So Sumptu and Meriniel exchanged nervous glances.
We seek only to please the Spider Queen,
so Sumptu replied, her voice thick with proper deference and supplication.
She is pleased by strength, said the Yawklal.
It was a surprising answer to both the priestesses, in that it did not include any variation or synonym to the word chaos, which was the very edict and domain of Lady Loth. The gooey mass shifted then, turning slowly and thinning as it went. The tentacles shrank and became arms, drow arms, and drow legs, as the creature transformed into the guise of a female drow, naked and glorious. With a wry grin, the handmaiden walked over to Meriniel and gently lifted her hand to stroke the drow's cheek and chin.
Are you afraid, daughter of Matron Mother Quint?
The Yawklal-turned-drow asked. Meriniel, now visibly trembling, swallowed hard.
We sense that the goddess is in pain, or is in distress, so Sumptu interjected.
But the Yawklal held up a hand to silence the older drow, and never turned her penetrating gaze from Meriniel. The handmaiden's hand drifted lower, around Meriniel's delicate jaw and gently, lightly down her neck. The young Bayenri seemed to So Sumptu on the verge of panic. Despite her misgivings regarding Meriniel, So Sumptu lifted her hand into Meriniel's view and her fingers flashed the word, strength. Meriniel firmed up immediately and shook her head.
We are House Bayenri, she said solidly. If Lady Loth is in need, we are here to serve, that is all.
But you tremble at the touch of a handmaiden, the Yawklal replied. Are you afraid, or do I so disgust you?
So Sumptu held her breath, knowing that if Meriniel answered incorrectly, the Yawklal would likely drag her back to the demon web pits for an eternity of torment. But Meriniel smiled, then suddenly embraced the handmaiden in a passionate kiss. So Sumptu nodded in admiration, silently congratulating the play of the young priestess. A long while later, So Sumptu and Meriniel walked side by side through the halls of the Bayenri main house on their way to report to the matron mother. They had learned little from the handmaiden directly, which was typical of such encounters.
Why?
Meriniel asked quietly. She didn't have to elaborate.
so Sumptu could have allowed her to fail the handmaiden's test and been rid of her once and for all, and every drow in Manzo Baranzon knew that so Sumptu Bayenri would like nothing more than to be rid of Quenthel's troublesome and ambitious daughter.
"You thought it a test?" so Sumptu replied.
Mirenial stopped walking and considered the older priestess.
"You think the handmaiden's call for strength is aimed at you?"
so Sumptu asked and scoffed.
"Is it an experience, then, or stupidity that propels you? Or arrogance, perhaps? Yes, that would be a proper failing for a child of Quenthel."
For many heartbeats, Mirenial didn't respond, didn't even blink, and so Sumptu could see her rolling the insult over and over in her thoughts, looking for an angle of counterattack.
"You dare speak of the matron mother with such disrespect," came the predictable retort. "The test was for me,"
so Sumptu declared. And she started walking again briskly, forcing Mirenial to move swiftly to catch up.
"And as such, for House Bayenri wholly."
Mirenial, who had, after all, just made love to a half-melted lump of dirty wax, wore a most delicious and perplexed expression.
"When a handmaiden takes the illusion of a drow, does she see through the eyes of the drow?"
so Sumptu asked.
"What do you mean?" "The Yoklo physically watched me while she faced you, young fool,"
so Sumptu explained.
"She saw my sign to you to show strength as clearly as you did, and that was the whole point of the exercise. Something is wrong. The Spider Queen is greatly upset and demands strength."
"Unity," Mirenial quietly breathed.
"Unity among the two nobles of House Bayenri least likely to provide it."
Mirenial's eyes went wide.
"Do you think that the rivalry between the High Priestess of House Bayenri and the daughter of Matron Mother Quenthel would go unnoticed?"
so Sumptu replied.
"I remain at Erech Tynaleth, serving Mistress Minolin Fay,"
Mirenial said innocently.
"But you will never replace Minolin,"
so Sumptu said slyly.
"Or Ardul Rey of House Melarn as Matron of Scriptures. With those appointments, the matron mother, your mother, satisfies two rival houses, potential enemies House Bayenri prefers not to deal with in this dangerous time of House Zor Lauren's departure. But then you know this."
The innocent look was gone from Mirenial's face now, so Sumptu noted. The young priestess assumed a rather brash posture.
"Unity now,"
so Sumptu said against that threatening pose.
"The Spider Queen demands it."
The words sounded quite curious to her as she spoke them. And to Mirenial as well, she realized, when the younger priestess responded simply,
"Why?"
So Sumptu could only sigh and shrug against that all-important question. The handmaiden had revealed little, her largest hint being an obscure reference that
"the Eternal would understand."
They had arrived at Quenthel's door by then. Mirenial lifted her hand to knock, but a look from So Sumptu warned her away.
"Unity requires adherence to station, young one,"
So Sumptu explained. And it was she who knocked, she who answered the matron mother's call, and she who entered Quenthel's private chambers first. Groff smiled as his door swung open, and predictably, Matron Mother Quenthel swept into the room.
"She taunts me,"
Quenthel whined. She moved up to the chair she had previously used and started to sit down, but instead just kicked it aside.
"The Eternal would know," the handmaiden whispered to So Sumptu and Mirenial. "The Eternal! Our mother would know, but alas, mere Quenthel cannot."
Gromph realized that his chuckle might not be appreciated at that moment, but he couldn't hold it back. The reference, the Eternal, was clear enough, speaking of their mother, Evenel, who was known as Evenel the Eternal, the greatest matron mother Menzo Baranzon had ever known, and one who had ruled the city for millennia.
And now you dare to taunt me? Quenthal fumed. Would you ever have so responded to Evenel?
Of course not, the old archmage replied. Evenel would have killed me.
But mere Quenthal cannot, so you suppose?
The matron mother's features tightened into a dangerous scowl. Grumpf casually rose.
You won't, he replied. Whether you